knowing that there was a lot more to life and refusing to allow my circumstances to define me. Luckily for me, I can't speak for other countries, but I grew up seeing very powerful women on Kenyan television. They were educated, they were smart, they were bold, they were eloquent, they held positions of power. And I looked at these women and I said, it's possible. Oh, hi, my name is Ondira Oganga. I am a business journalist by profession and a digital content creator. I've worked in the media space for the last 6 years, and I've covered the African continent from East Africa to West Africa, and now largely the continent at large. And my experience in the newsroom is very diverse. I started out as a news reporter, worked all my way up to anchor and editor, and now I work as an African correspondent.
It's Kellen, and today on Diversified Game, I have the Queen of Media. I have the big O from the big A, Africa. Yes. Like if Oprah had a career child, this journalist here, who's a trained journalist, we got to add, she might be in Africa, but she has certificates and qualifications from here in America, like Columbia, just one of those small Ivy League places. But Honduras, who has worked with us for a while now at the African Diaspora News Channel, was so gracious to come do this show. And I say gracious because usually she's asking the questions or giving the game, but she came here and is going to let me not pick her brain, but just kind of go down the journey to show how she started, sustained, and succeeded. So, Honduras, welcome to Diversified Game. How you doing? Uhaligani.
Thank you so much. Salama. Thank you for having me, Nico. Salama,
Maposana, let's get into it. I'm going to ask you like one of our classic Black American movies asked about hip hop, but when did you fall in love with journalism, reporting, and the news?
I think I've always been a very artsy kind of person, and I gravitate more towards people. I love talking to people. I love listening to people. I grew up in Kenya, Africa, but a country called Kenya. And one of the things that my parents did from a very early on age is to introduce us to media. So that was from international media, which shaped our global perception and global perspective. And also reading. We used to read a lot. We used to read newspapers and we used to read glossy magazines. So that was almost my gateway out of Africa. Every time I would read them, I would feel like I am in this completely whole other world. And these magazines would range from fashion to travel to lifestyle. And also we read a lot of literature. Unfortunately, it wasn't Western literature. I read a lot of African literature, literature from West Africa, from East Africa, from South Africa. And so storytelling just gradually got embedded in my DNA. And, growing up, I got teased that I talk a lot, but I guess it's just because I'm a very inquisitive person. I like listening to people and I just like getting to know people. So when it was time to pick a career, I think journalism just made sense.
You said you talk a lot. I said you are a woman and an African woman at that. And in America they say, Kelly, you're about to get canceled. No, I'm talking the way I talk, but I haven't met a really shy, when she's in her mix, African woman. African women are going to talk. That's for all you passport bros who think you're about to go over there and buy yourself a dainty, just, mute. Tell the people though, what was it about? You're like a traveler. You're all over. You can go from Ghana to, I'm popping my collar, Rwanda. What is it? Are you just a traveler by nature? Is it that you can't sit still? What is it about being on the move and groove? Because a lot of people now are like moving and they're leaving their homeland, and it's like they're not running from anything, but they're running to something. So what is travel and that urge? When did that start and why?
Well, I think it still goes back to the history of being introduced to a whole other world through media, through magazines, through books. My imagination has always been wild, even as a child. And I think that wild imagination then went on to feed and fuel my ambition. And so I'm that kind of person who I don't want to say I'm never content. I know where I am and I know how far I can go. And so whichever place I'm at, I just put in enough work to catapult me to the next place. And honestly, where opportunities take me is where I go. And it might look glossy and easy on the outside. It's not, but I think it's always been worth it. And then again, it just goes back to getting to know people. I mean, we hear, even as Africans, we just hear a lot about Africa from international media because even as Africans, we do not necessarily cover ourselves. We do not tell our stories. You know, I just came back from South Africa. The place is beautiful. You know, I came back, the time that I was there, it was almost during the summer rain season. The jacarandas are finally beginning to shade. It's a beautiful place. But the things that we hear about that place is are all the challenges, the poverty, the crime, the xenophobia. Yes, that exists, but there's a whole other dimension to these places. So I think for me, what fuels that curiosity is just to get to know these places, get to experience these people, and that also shapes me and makes me a better journalist.
How do you make sure you get all sides? Because when you say that about South Africa on this side now, and it wasn't like this in the 90s, of course, everything is beautiful about South Africa. It's, oh, have you been? Doesn't matter if you're Black American, Black Jamaican, if you are, you know, a, I had another word, but if you are, whatever, you could be a white person. Everybody, South Africa, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. What is, how do you cover all sides and make sure that you're not just, you know, tackling, you know, the Kenyan lens or the African lens of South Africa?
Well, I think this is something I've caught a lot of flack for because I, as much as I create content online, I am a trained journalist.
First.
The government is intending to borrow from both bilateral and multilateral lenders to help repay its $2 billion Eurobond that is due next year in June. And the cabinet secretary to the National Treasury, Njuguna Ndong'o, says that if the funding cannot be arranged in due time, then they might have to dip into their reserves. However, one thing that he's completely ruled out is going back to the capital markets to refinance. And part of our training is to be very objective, and objectivity comes in different forms. Hear both sides of the story. Somebody tells you it's raining, open the curtains and confirm that it's actually raining outside. So just hearing both sides and just saying the truth as it is, no matter how uncomfortable it is, you know, there's also data out there to help you back whatever it is that you're saying. I remember when I moved to Ghana, I would do all these videos of all the amazing things in Ghana. And I thought to myself, I have had challenges here. Wouldn't it be interesting to do a video just documenting all the challenges that I have experienced here so that when somebody is coming, they also have this other perspective? And it wasn't in any way to taint the country or the experience. It was just to say, hey, things go great here, but the things that do not go great, so brace yourself. And embracing yourself, it means you come fully prepared, right? For example, they take rent 2 years up front. That's not a bad thing. It's just different. And it can be a challenge if you didn't know about that. So you've left, you've packed your bags, you've left America. You didn't factor that in your budget. You know, healthcare sometimes does not work the same way on the African continent as it does in other places, or even just in different African continent. On the continent, the health dynamics in different countries work in very different ways. And I caught so much flak for that video. I was bullied. People said, go back to Kenya. Oh, yeah. And I was like, what did I actually do? Because these are challenges that are there. If I don't talk about them, it doesn't make them go away. And if we're actually telling people to come, we need to objectively tell them what is waiting for them, a full picture, so that they make an informed decision. And should they choose to come, then they can be fully prepared so that they don't come for 1 year or 2 years and everything gets extremely overwhelming. So I think that being objective is an uphill task for journalists, and we keep learning and we keep growing, but you do your best to just try and represent the facts as they are.
Are there any rituals that you have to try to be objective in any, you know, in school they'll teach you so many ways of, oh, you have to have this checked off and this checked off. But when you're really in the field and you're at a tight deadline, it's like, you know, I don't have time, or you know, I don't have the resources sometimes, depending, you could be stuck in, you know, the middle of nowhere. Do you have any rituals that you do to try to help with that objectivity?
Yeah, I think data is one of them. It goes a long way. Data verifies what you're trying to say or what people are trying to say. But the second thing is just try and verify. You know, if somebody tells me Kellen was here, it doesn't have to pick a phone call and give Kellen a call and ask, "Were you actually here?" And if I can't reach Kellen, I can go to the establishment that they said Kellen was at and try and confirm, was Kellen actually here? So I think it's part of the training. You need to have both sides and you need to get your facts straight. I'd rather delay a story and have it factual than have to correct or recall it. That's embarrassing.
And if they say Kellen is there, and you say, but Kellen's social media says he's over here, that's because my twin brother and my clone is there, just so you guys know. So sometimes you can't be in two places at once, but you got to be Kellen. Tell the people, especially the young, inspiring journalists, it is not hard. It's not like, this is the biggest money maker for most people. But even getting that first job, I remember coming out of grad school and people saying, they were stressed, like, what are they gonna do? And only for having a business was I not in that same boat, but I had my own different stresses of how do I keep this business afloat? How did you get your foot in the door? And then we know journalism is not what you're doing, but what you're gonna do next. How have you like steadily graduated? Because you've worked for some of the biggest news places out there. And that's for they can go on your LinkedIn to go see that. But I mean, I mentioned Columbia, also MIT. You'll see that she's got a world of information, but how did you get your first job?
It's so interesting because I was still in school my final year. This might sound cocky, but I was just one of those top achieving students, always top of my class, all the way from primary to high school and even campus. I think that my parents worked very hard to instill work ethic, discipline, and just clarity in our vision. And my siblings and I have always known what we wanted for ourselves. And even if you're not certain of how you were going to get it, you knew certain things were within your power and you could control them, one of them being the amount of work that you put in. And I think that eventually that work begins to pay off, you know, when you're getting straight A's, you're working on your assignments. And our training in media is very practical. So when they send you out to do stories and you bring really good stories and they see that you have the potential to become a good journalist and you're a great student, then they begin recommending you. So it was my fourth year in school. Our head of department, Dr. Peruz Wenje, reached out and said to some of us in class, I think he reached out to five of us and said, "There's this station, they're looking for talent. Send them your picture and your resume." I did send them my picture and my resume, and I went home after finishing exams, because it takes about 6 months before you graduate. And while I was home, I got a call from them saying, "Please come for an interview." And during the interview process, they said, "We like the work that you did during your internship." And then this again just speaks to that pushing myself. During my internship, Monday to Friday, I would shadow reporters. And then over the weekend, I would go and say, "I would like to do my own stories." And I was able to do a couple of stories that I use them as links to get my first job. So that's how I went through the interview process. I got the first job, and yeah, the rest is history.
And getting your first job is a setup for your next job. Once you get your foot in the door, for that young journalist, what should they be working on? Because sometimes people think, oh, I gotta get a big story. I gotta get the biggest story, the biggest scandal, so I can catapult myself to the next level. And once you get your foot in the door, what was that next step for you to say, okay, now I need to do what?
To learn, Helen, to learn. This is the first time that you're in the market as a practitioner. Then what you do is you learn. I don't like saying put your head down and learn. Sometimes you need to put your head up so you can see what's actually going on around you. But find like-minded people in the newsroom. Find people whose career path is aligned to exactly what you want to do. Shadow them. Ask as many questions as possible. Be willing to look like a fool. You know, it's not easy. When you're learning, it's going to be very hard. And even right now, I just transitioned to an international company. It's so hard. I want to quit every day because I feel so foolish. But then that is the process of learning. You put in the hours and you do whatever it takes. And this is not to your detriment. This is just saying that you're willing to ride out the discomfort. You're willing to put in the extra work. You're willing to do the research. You're willing to sit with an editor to learn how to edit. Because when you learn these things, yes, they're not part of your job description, but they make you a better reporter. So when you go out there, even when you're shooting, when you're writing, then you're doing everything from a holistic point of view, which just makes you a better journalist. So I think your first job is your place to acclimatize with the work environment and begin learning as much about the job as possible.
Tell the people, the difference between, I'll just say for like here over when you're working with us, we are very relaxed. You're doing things on your own time, doing it your way versus doing it the way they teach you in school. Because journalism has changed. It's like a 180 for some, a 360 for others, especially with African journalists when they come and they're like, oh, well, I have to say this and I have to be proper. And it's like, calm a day, calm down. We want you because YouTube is and social media is very different than your traditional TV. That was difficult to explain to professors in grad school. Because when you're making as much or more than the professors while you're in grad school, it's like, no, this is the new way of doing things. How have you, transformed or what have you learned? Are you always like saying, oh no, here I gotta be me. Over here, I gotta be, the more, I guess, proper me. Tell the audience if there's a difference to you. Maybe there's not.
I think for me personally, there's a big difference because I practice business journalism and there's very little room for personality, heart, and soul in that. It's just hardcore numbers. You go there, you give the numbers as they are, and you go home. But then again, there's a way that we find to personalize these numbers, to give them a heart and a soul and make them relatable. So I think bits and pieces of my creativity and my storytelling come in there. But I think YouTube is just this wonderful space. The digital media is just this wonderful space that allows journalists to be, or even creatives in general, to be, all your creative energies. You can make mistakes, you can experiment, you can try, because audiences on YouTube, that's what they're looking for. They're not looking for perfection because TV is cut, copy, paste. Like there's already a model to how things work. But the internet, we are all trying to figure it out as we go, and it keeps changing. So that allows us more creative freedom.
Is there one that you prefer more over the others? If all things are equal, unlike our fingers, that, this is the one that I think this is where the future is, especially, and give me your opinion too, how AI will be changing journalism and all this, Web3 technology. But which one do you look prefer more and, the AI, the future?
I think that's a difficult question to answer because I have worked in media and then I worked in digital media, then I'm now working in both. I think initially I was very content with just working in media. I'm a very, contrary to what people think, I like my space. I like my privacy. I like my life. I could go about my life without social media. I studied in China. That's a funny thing. And while I was there, for a really long time, I didn't have access to WhatsApp and Instagram and Facebook because when I went, I didn't download VPN. And I realized you can live without these things. And so that quiet moment just made me realize that actually, I am not that very big fan of digital media. However, we cannot underscore the importance that it plays. It's now a medium of communication. It's a medium of information. It's a medium of education and entertainment. And it's here to stay. If anything, it's the one that will give television a run for its money, if not making it irrelevant and redundant. So I used to prefer TV because that was the training and that's what we knew. But with changing times and changing trends, I'm beginning to warm up to the power of social media, the audiences that it opens you up to, the creative freedom that it gives you, the things that it exposes you to, and the things that you also get to learn. And also the good thing is that it pushes the creative boundary it just keeps pushing the boundary. When you think you've seen the best video on the internet, just give it a day, and there's another one that has gone leaps and bounds above what you imagine. With how AI and technology is revolutionizing media, it's already here, honestly. If anything, social media is already it, and algorithms, it's just a whole system on its own. And it's very important for newsrooms to begin to adapt and align to these changes in technology, because you disrupt or you be disrupted. And as is, very many newsrooms have been disrupted. Those that are surviving are those that disrupted themselves earlier on.
And, with AI and Web3, do you see yourself in the future ever being, the AI version of you, the cartoon or whatever character, hologram, where, at this point right now, you could have the computer write your scripts for you, have your voice on audio, have it do it automatically and put it out to whatever your image is. And it's like, where are we going? Where do you see the future for yourself? Like, how deep do you want to go down this rabbit hole? Is it red pill or blue pill? This is the matrix we're in.
If I'm being honest, I genuinely have not thought that far, because also the newsroom is very demanding. And the older I grow, the more I realize I don't want to be there for a long time. Maybe I have another 10 or 15 good years in me. If AI and technology disrupts it, then I'll find a way of adapting. But I do not think that that is a long-term plan for me. Yeah, I haven't thought that far, because I do not intend to be in media for that long. I know it's strange, but yeah, I just feel like there was a time that media had a real impact, and now the change and the impact that the media can bring is becoming little and little every day. And it just makes it a little bit harder to go to bed knowing that there's nothing you could have done.
Also, you're into the you want to have a real hold on change. What would be the next step? If it is it owning a media production house? Is it financing? Are you going into a whole nother form of business? Maybe there's some investors out there who say, "Hey, we want to get in that business with you."
I think I've always loved Africa and telling African stories. And that for me would be the next phase. Just getting to a place where I can tell our stories through our lens, through our own voice, and show bits and pieces of us that are very authentically us. I was just watching a lovely documentary about tech in Nigeria, but it was done by, somebody who's not from Nigeria and who's not Nigerian. And in as much as I can appreciate what they were trying to do, I'm just like, if this was done by an African and more so a Nigerian, it would have been such a beautiful story, So I think the world is beginning to open up to African stories, but they're not necessarily telling them through the African lens. And I would like to create material that is consumed by Africans for Africans. And if the world marvels at it, that's a bonus. But I think that it's important that Africans begin seeing the continent through their own eyes.
Okay. So filmmaking and take over or partner with the Mzungus, but give the African perspective. And that's needed because, one thing I always tell people when we bring folks over as group trips is I sometimes see Black Americans being the new colonizers of Africa if they do not decolonize their mind. And they come over with, this capitalist mindset. Oh, I can get everything cheap and the people are more friendly and they're doing more than what they get here in America for most people. But where do you think, when you see Black Americans and the way they see Africa, do they see it the same way as the African sees it, or even partially? Because you can't see everything with the same lens because you come from two different places. But I mean, what's your opinion on that?
I've interacted with a couple of people in Accra, Ghana, who have relocated. I think, first of all, it's very important to note that relocation is not easy. It's one of the biggest life decisions that anybody can ever make. And I also feel like we over-romanticize the continent and people get disappointed a lot. There are challenges that are in America that do not exist on the African continent. And then there are challenges that exist in Africa that do not exist in America. And when you can bridge this gap and know the difference, then it makes your stay on the African continent a little bit more easier. I also believe that there are many who come with very good intentions, you know. Yeah, there's so much you can do on the African continent because some areas and sectors are still very green and you see opportunity, but also it's not a straightforward line, right? And you can easily get very frustrated by a couple of things that we're used to here but do not exist in America. So I think I have met people with extremely good intentions, and I've also met people who their intentions were not aligning with where the continent is at and where it's going. And so it made it very hard for them to be here, do whatever it is they wanted, and they just packed their bags and went back to America.
And you know what? There's nothing wrong, you guys, if you don't fit in. Just like Nigeria, talk Ghana. We need an American must-go bag too for some of you, especially if you don't come over with the resources and the mindset that it's going to fit. Because we don't need any more Wahala. We need unity. We need, you know, folks getting. Let me ask you though this, and this is going to be very personal. You stop me anytime. And let me just premise that. This is just how I see things. In Africa, you have people who, it's like a lot of times the West, whatever that is, okay, we're going to do things Western style, but not with the Western mind. Like in the West, everything, people are going all over the world to go get their bodies done. You know, in the West, somebody would tell you, Anduru, maybe you should think about your gap, which we love the gap. It makes you different, right? I try to tell my youngest one who has a gap, I said, no, this gap makes you different. But maybe you should wear your hair like this. Maybe you should go to the DR. Maybe you should go to Colombia. And here we have like these Twilight Zone body morph, people are morphing their body to look a certain way. Whereas in Africa, a man, if he's balding, you guys don't talk about my hairline, too bad. But it's okay. No one cares. The gap, no one cares. No one is saying go to, at least I'm not hearing it in masses, go to Turkey, go to Dubai, go get your body done. There's a shallowness in America that Africa does not have. Do you see that? And what do you think that professionally? Will you not get a raise if you don't look a certain way?
I think it's a double-edged sword. I'm a dark-skinned woman, and I'll give you both sides. So I'm going to start with the bad, and then I'm going to finish with the good. We cannot deny the effects of colonization and the leftover effect, the residual effect that it has. There's colorism on the African continent. Lighter people are considered more pretty. I am a dark-skinned woman. I am a River Lake Nilotes. I am a Luo. And that's just how it is. My ancestors come from South Sudan. It's not possible to be light. You know, I'm going to be dark. And I have seen it. I have seen it where girls that look like me, we have to be smart in school, and we have to be really great at art and really great at sport. And even Lupita Nyong'o, the Kenyan actress who's won an Oscar, talks about it and says, if you're not considered beautiful, by beautiful means being light, then you have to overcompensate by other things. Oh, she's not pretty, but she's smart. She's not pretty according to our standards, but you know, she gets good grades, she has a great job, and all those things. And while it might be difficult, it goes a long way in shaping us and making us all-rounded individuals who you enjoy sitting down with and having a conversation with. I have had my own personal experiences with makeup artists. Unfortunately, I work in media, where they have just outrightly told me I don't belong. There was a time I broke down in tears because I wanted red lipstick, and he said, "Red lipstick doesn't look good on dark skin. You should know this by now." And I'm like, "What do you mean? I've really worked hard to be in this newsroom, and you're the makeup artist. And if I want something that will make me feel good, just do your job. Don't make me feel. What am I supposed to do about my skin now? Go and bleach it? What am I supposed to do about it?" And other makeup artists have just they show preference to the lighter girls. Now that I live here in Kigali, I realize that I've used several makeup artists, and none of them ever posted my work. And then recently, I went on social media, and I had somebody talking about how even nail technicians and makeup artists, they don't post people who are not fair. And I'm just now at a place where I want to work with people that are not going to make me feel like my beauty is different, because again, there's no monolithic way of being African. And I think that's the essence of African beauty. Outside of the colorism, beauty in Africa is very, very, very diverse. This gap in my teeth in Kenya, in Uganda, here in Rwanda, it's considered very beautiful. It doesn't have a lot of significance in West Africa. Now, in West Africa, when you're a woman and you have hairy legs, it's beautiful. West African women are very busty. It's beautiful. And the men do not even care if the bust comes with a little bit of tummy, because it's fat. Women's bodies are not supposed to. Women are just supposed to be women, right? If you go to South Africa, the way they're built, they have nice legs. They're shaped really well. If you go to Sudan, skin like butter, very beautiful dark skinned women. And that has allowed African women to just be, because your beauty is appreciated where you are. And if it's not appreciated there, it's appreciated elsewhere. In Ghana, I never felt insecure about the color of my skin because majority of them are dark and they just appreciate dark skin. So I think that diversity in beauty allows us to find some confidence, comfort, and solace in who we are. Yes, the efforts are beginning to get here, the Kardashian effect, where we all think this is what is beautiful. But then again, I'm going to tell you something. So my older sister and I, we have a 10-year gap. And in 2003, 2002, she went to medical school. I was really young. I'm not going to like say my age because people are good mathematicians. So I would see her do so many sit-ups and work out so hard, because back in those days, when you looked at the music videos, all the vixens were very slim and skinny from the effects of the heroin chick in the 90s. So in the 2000s, you had to be as skinny as possible and wear the low cut jeans. And I saw her wreck her body just to fit into that stereotype. Guess what? Now, thick is in. And sometimes we laugh about it and we're like, oh my God, if only you knew, you wouldn't have bothered. And even now the thick is in, Ozempics are here. And we're telling you, yeah, slim is barking. So I think just recognizing that these things come and go, the trends come and go, is very, very important. And also, no celebrity does anything out of the goodness of their heart. They're paid a lot of money to go under anesthesia and get the surgeries done so that they can influence you to go and get those surgeries. And it will never stop. It will never be enough. We live in a world where there's always another thing you can nip and tuck. Once you start, it's a rabbit hole. So I think I appreciate the diversity of beauty on the African continent that just allows us to find a place where you can be beautiful as you are.
Amen. Be whoever you are. That beauty really comes from the inside. And it's funny because, your supermodels like Ducky or Zuri or Kenya's first supermodel and my friend Ajuma, dark, dark, dark. Oh, Ajuma. Yeah.
Yes. What do you mean? Ajuma is
That.
like a legend.
Yes, she's been on this show. So I've had a legend on this show.
Oh,
We met.
wow.
Yeah, we met in Kenya. I thank my other friend, Olive Gashara, for hooking that up. A real lion in Kenya, because she's on the lion's den, y'all, when that show was going. So that's why it's like Shark Tank. You guys can Google that. But if you know, you know. That's what they say, right? Okay, I was gonna go with another joke. I'm gonna stop. But talk about, also not just the cosmetic, even the hair. I have a real problem in Africa. Even in my dear Sierra Leone, when I see the judges wearing the wigs, I really love black women's hair. I like the smell of it. I like the feel of it. I like to wake up and when I see my madame, I'm like, yes. Do you feel pressure that, well, we have to keep our wigs and we can't just wear our cornrows on, air? Will that ever
Ever
change?
change. I wouldn't necessarily call it pressure. I would say it's just been a gradual education, right? And you have to know the history of beauty. When our parents were growing up, they would perm their hair because straight and relaxed hair was the it thing. And now it's first of all, actually it started with afros because I have pictures of my dad with those big afros. So there was a time that afro and African hair was actually a thing. Then it went to perming, curling, and straightening your hair. And now the wigs are here. There's a case to be made for both. I think whatever makes you feel beautiful, go for it. Sometimes it's protective styling and makes it very easy. And you just throw on your wig and you go. But then again, where I don't agree is where, African women are made to feel that what their hair and the styles that they choose to do for their hairs are not professional. But here, I can only speak for the African continent. We're seeing many African workplaces begin to just allow people to wear their hair. Here, we do a lot of braids. People do cornrows. Some keep their natural hair as is. Now, people are getting into the business of creating good products for hair. So that actually just goes a long way. And there was a time on the Africa Diaspora News channel that I wore my natural hair and I went to the comment section and people were not even commenting about the video. They were just like, oh my God, you have beautiful hair. And that was good to see. That was good to see. So I think we're making a lot of progress in just making women of color feel comfortable with the different textures of their hair and allowing them to wear their hair whichever way they please.
Yes, and that's the real thing because this isn't the Manosphere Passport Bro show where we start telling women what to do and how to do it. Your people, you do what you feel comfortable with, even if you cut it all off, like we see in that African continent, and it looks good because you can still, you get the essence of the person. Can you talk about a community give back that you are doing or one that you would like to do in the future with all the success that you've had? I know you're doing something.
I think for me, just to take you back a little bit, I grew up in the slums of Kawangware, and music was something that gave me so much hope. When I would go for music practice, I wasn't that poor kid. I was just a happy kid. It was one thing that I excelled at without pressure of having to be good. Stakes were not high. And that is one thing that I would like one day to give back, to get to a place where kids can come, sing, they can dance, they can learn instruments, particularly kids from less fortunate backgrounds, because sometimes you easily get blinded by your surrounding. And when it's a constant reminder, you get to see it every single day, and there's nothing to look forward to. Then 18 years or 20 years to work out of something is really hard if there's nothing on the side that brings you joy and motivates you. So I would like to do that. I used to do that when I was in Kenya. I do poetry and I do music, and I would go to very small schools, like literally very small schools that could not even afford to pay me. And I would tell the principal, I am going to take your kids all the way to the nationals in the Kenya competitions of schools. And they'll be like, shut up, you can't do that. And I'd write these poems and I'd teach the kids. And this was small schools that nobody knew. And all the schools that I taught for the 4 years that I was in campus, all of them went to the nationals. And you could just see something changing in them, just pouring life in them. And reminding them that I am like them. I came from the slums. Literally, we struggled to make ends meet. but I held on to something bigger. And art brought me a little bit of joy while I was pursuing a greater purpose, and I'd like that for them. And I could see it would build confidence in them. They would begin to believe in themselves. They would begin to believe in the beauty of their dreams. They would begin to see possibility, because sometimes you're doomed even before you start. And this just gave me, it reassured me and validated the fact that it's very important that we just keep giving kids hope, irrespective of what way it comes. It's very, very important that we give that to them. And so eventually, when I just take a step back, that's one thing that I want to focus on a lot. I have friends who studied music. I used to sing in a band. I play the piano really, really well. So these are things that, together with my friends, I would just like to do, because it's just important that kids know that their surrounding and their background doesn't define them. And it's important that they see a personification of their dream, like a manifestation. You were just like me the other day, and this is where you are. And it's literally possible. So just creating that safe space for kids to come, be kids, be happy, learn an extra skill that can earn them money through art, and most importantly, just pour positivity in them.
How is the real question if that 14-year-old or even that 44-year-old, if they're still in the slums, no matter where they are? You say you come from the slums. Ajuma comes from nothing. Mara, who I know you know, is in Quebrada, my dear friend and sister, Mara. Oh, that's somebody I talk to every week. But how do you take the next step to get out is the question. And some people are their work is inside of the slums, like Mara. But how does someone get out? I'm barely paying school fees. What was that one thing for you that where you saw the hope to say, I can get out of here? Because some people, if they can't see it, they can't achieve it.
I think just knowing that there was a lot more to life and refusing to allow my circumstances to define me. Luckily for me, I can't speak for other countries, but I grew up seeing very powerful women on Kenyan television. They were educated, they were smart, they were bold, they were eloquent, they held positions of power. And I looked at these women and I said, it's possible. If they can do it, I can do it. And they used to come to also our schools, no matter how small, they would come and they would talk to us. I remember three women that I really admire: Mary Onyango, who passed away, Justice Njoki Ndong'o, and what's the name? Florence Jaoko. These were very like strong and very powerful women in government that I would see on television, and they came to our school to talk to us. And their conversations would range from a couple of things because of the challenges that we see. They would remind us that they also came from nothing, and their way out was education. They would say, what you can control is education. Fortunately for us, the Kenyan government, when I was in school, has heavily subsidized education. So a lot of people can get an education. No matter the quality, put your best foot forward. Put in as much work as you can. Sit down and study. Block out the noise. Sit down and study. Get good grades, then figure it out from there. Another lady came and spoke about just dreaming big. Whatever it is that you want, dream it. You know, don't let just because you're in the village, you think this is your life. No, you want to be a lawyer, it's possible. And she would talk us through like, these are the subjects that you need to be good at. These are the courses. This is the schools that you look at. And things like that. And also because we are girls and very susceptible to teenage pregnancies and early marriages, another would come and talk to you about, you know, this thing that you fancy, your teenager hormones are raging. They're like, listen, it ain't that deep. It ain't that deep. It ain't that interesting. Take your time, go through school, be a child, you know, fear men, you'll get pregnant. You'll be the one to leave school. They'll keep living their life, and also just empowered us as girls. You know, that they instill the idea of choice. You choose as a woman. You don't wait to be chosen or to be told, and that gave us so much power, or at least gave me so much power. So I knew I can get out of my circumstances by education. It's not a guarantee, but at least that is what is in your control. Get good grades, then leave the rest to the universe to figure out. Then have a clear career path. Do not let anybody tell you that this is not necessarily possible, because in my family, I'm the first one to work in media, and even in the extended family, international media. If you would just say something like that, and luckily for me, my parents, even though they didn't have a lot, they were very open-minded, so they were very supportive. But there are people who can easily shut that down. And when it comes to men, unfortunately, yeah, now it's changing, but relationships, it's a very patriarchal society, and women always get the short end of the stick. And so I always knew that when time is right, I will choose the man that I want. And if it's not working, I have a choice to leave. And I always knew that if you are an independent woman, you don't need a man. You want a man. And so this just made me feel very empowered and just go for whatever it is that I wanted. I'm not saying it is easy. When I summarize it like that, it sounds very easy. But what's within your control? Work on that. Is it getting good grades? Get good grades. Can you afford, or can you manage to stay out of trouble and stay out of crime? Do that. Can you, if social media is taking so much of your time and messing with with your brain, avoid it. Just be a kid. If you're young, focus on what you can focus on, and then let the universe figure out the rest.
Amen. You guys, when she says they want a man, that's not a slight at you, because I know a lot of guys. See, that's one of those independent, you should want independence, because when you sit there and you have surgery, you need somebody who's competent to make sure you come out and take care of you and the family and the empire that you built. That's for the men. They get it, because sometimes they hear that and they just shut off and, oh, an independent woman. I don't know
No,
what that,
Kellen, Kellen. No, let's actually get into that for a little bit. I am an African. I come from Africa. If a woman does not have money, it opens up the door for very many things. Abuse is one of them. The quality of life that as a woman. I think that many people forget that homes are primarily run by women. When the kids are sick, yes, the men will do, they'll pay the rent, they'll pay the school fees, and then that's it. Right? The home is primarily run by the women. And when you do not have money or financial backing, it leaves you in a very compromising position. I grew up here and I saw very many cases of women being abused, being in situations that they didn't need to endure. Women have stayed in very bad relationships and very bad marriages for their own self and even for their children, just so their children can get an education. What this means is, when you're your own person, then you earn the right to live a dignified life, right? When I say I want a man, it means I'm choosing to dignify myself by allowing whoever sees me as a human being, a partner, and an equal into my space. Not because I need you for anything, but because I want companionship and I want partnership. And those are the only things that I ask from you. And those are the things that you ask from me. I do not need you to secure my financial future, because that puts me in a compromising position. If you're not a good person, you can easily turn on me. I have seen this script so many times. And that's why I don't know about other parts of Africa, but in Kenya, women are encouraged to have their own so that we can escape that perpetual cycle of abuse.
It's so deep in Kenya. There's some years ago, we actually tried to work with Chow, who does radio out there. We tried to get in on this mental health thing because I saw a report in Kenya. It was in a more rural area, but it was a report as Kenyan men were killing themselves more, suicide. I said, why? And I saw one of the guys do a report, and they were in the township, council, and he said, because our women aren't listening to us and we can't beat them anymore. And I said, what? You can't beat the women anymore, so they're killing themselves. I said, this is shocking, because you can't beat a woman, you'll rather die. That might be what your book should be about, maybe. And she is going to write a book.
Do you see how messed up that is, that a person cannot
Very.
fathom a life where they do not oppress you? And this is not to say that they're not good people out there. It's just to say that how things work post-independence, men got the priority when it came to education. If it was you and your brother, they would say, let your brother continue with education, at least you'd get married. And that's where the cycle of abuse began, because you get married really young. What do? You have kids, and then you start providing domestic labor for this man that you're married to. And then the cycle continues and continues and continues. It has to stop somewhere. Women are human beings. We deserve to live dignified lives. We deserve to be happy. We deserve to chase our dreams. Sometimes I think of my mother. By the time she was my age, she already had me and my sister. I have no kids, and I have no intentions of having kids anytime soon, because I'm still in the process of just figuring out who I am and my career. And sometimes I weep for her dreams, what she could have been, what she wanted. But then again, she lived in a different times, and in those times, that's what they knew. Now we live in different times, and it's up to us to take advantage of the opportunities that we have now as women, because our moms and grandmothers did not have these opportunities. And I can say without the fear of contradiction, financial independence is the most important thing that a woman can have. All this moving around the continent that I do is because I can afford it. The education that I get is because I can afford it. I am not at the mercy of anyone. And this might sound like it's hypocritical, because I'm married to an amazing Fanti King, but he knows that I can hold my own. And he knows that with him, my life is so good. He makes it so much easy. But he knows, even when he was not in the picture, I was good. And that's where. That's it, sort of, it creates that difference where if you will not respect me just by being a person, you'll respect me by knowing that I can hold my own.
Well, it goes to that fabulous song, Make Me Better, or anything by, Jamie Foxx and I think Ne-Yo. I love her because she has her own. That's goals. Men who want to control things, and we have a lot, again, this whole passport bro movement. I've heard even somebody I had to cut off because he said, I'm bringing this woman from another country and I need to buy some acres like you because she's going to need a job after she has the kids. And I'm thinking, you're bringing someone from another country to have them work the farm? Are you kidding me? We can't talk anymore. Tira la puerta, you got to get out of here. So and they thought that, go ahead.
I'm just saying, like, that is how people think out here. But then in this hyperinflation economy where one's paycheck cannot run a household, you really need somebody that you can partner with, somebody who can put something on the table, somebody who does not necessarily wait for you when you have kids. You want to give your kids the best. COVID taught us that you can take pay cuts anytime, you can lose your job anytime, you can get a random virus, and you're maimed for life. So it only serves your best interest, man or woman, to partner with somebody that adds some value to your life outside of their womb.
Hello, as we like to say in the Bay Area, that's real talk and real spit. Again, what are your plans? When can the people expect for your first book to come out? Have you started writing it? Have you started editing it? Let them know.
You're the one that gave me the idea of the book the very first time. I think we got on one of our very long phone calls. We should get back on those. I think currently I'm just in the process of soaking life in and processing a lot of things that have happened in my life, because it's just been one thing after another after another. But the older I grow, the more I get comfortable in my own story, and there's no shame anymore. I'm trying to unshackle myself from the shame of the struggle that I had to go through, and I continue to go through. So it's something that will eventually come. But in the meantime, I remain a committed storyteller. They can always catch me on Africa Diaspora News Channel, where I share my opinion on geopolitical issues around the world and how they affect Africa. And also in December, we premiere a limited series on just people, places, culture, and food here in Rwanda.
You guys have gotten the game. Anything else you want to get from her, you can go to the African Diaspora, but you can also go to her own YouTube channel. It's her name. Links will be in the description because she needs to show her YouTube some more love too, y'all. She has a story. It needs to be told. Do you
No,
agree?
until YouTube begins paying African creators like it pays other creators, it defeats purpose because you put in 10 times the work and make a tenth of what your other creators are making outside of the African continent. So I think I'm growing into a smart African woman. I will put in the hard work, but I'll also be very smart with where I put that hard work in.
Well, there's a workaround that we'll talk about off air on that, and because we might have spoke about it, but there's also where I think people are going, and I think every influencer or whatever you call yourself out there should be working on your own portal, whether that's a website, an app. But with this whole Web3, you should be coming into my portal. And then with a token, you can go into Anduru's portal. And then with another token, where everybody is getting paid. And so you're staying in whatever your tribe is, as Seth Godin in Tribes, the book, you guys check that out, as he's written about. You find your tribe, you find where you're learning something, not just being entertained, but where you can hear real stories and people aren't saying, hey, you're going to be a millionaire tomorrow if you just blink your eyes and snap your fingers twice. This ain't that type of show. This is real stories from entrepreneurs and interesting creatives from around the world. You guys have gotten the game. I gotta go talk to my friend off air because I gotta tell her some more game that I only want her to know. I thank you for coming on. Any last words for the people?
There's more to the African continent than you see on TV and social media. So try and keep an open mind about the African continent and Africans. And I think on a personal level, it all makes sense in the long run. I am somebody who I have seen the pits of hell. I've gone to bed hungry. I have cried countless nights. I've gotten fired. I got retrenched during COVID. But I just did not stop. Cry through the night, wake up in the morning, dust yourself, pick yourself up, and keep pushing. Eventually, you'll meet people who will help you align and realign your goals, and it makes sense in the long run. Do not give up on yourself.
You guys have made it this far and been blessed by the game. Make sure you like this game. Make sure you subscribe. You can even give it a rating if you're listening, because majority of you are listening. But you can go give the YouTube some love and make sure, more importantly than anything else, you share this game with somebody. It will change their life. Y'all be blessed.
Hello everyone, this is Latasha Blanton from The Real South Africa Travel and Tourism. And you're going to have the opportunity to travel with Phil Scott to
sunny South Africa. You guys are going to have the opportunity to come to Johannesburg, and you guys are going to be coming to Durban. And we're going to set it up perfectly. It's going to be like a luxury experience for you guys. At the same time, you're going to be getting some culture. And of course, you're going to get an opportunity to talk to Phil, hang out with Phil, and get his views on Africa and South Africa.
You're also going to get an opportunity to explore the lifestyles here that are available in South Africa. And we're going to do all that for you in an amazing 10 days. We do hope that you go to the website and book because we do look forward to seeing you here.
Absolutely. Our website is therealsouthafrica.com. Go there, scroll down, you'll see a picture of Phil, and just go ahead and book there. So we'll see you here in what we like to call sunny
Sunny South
South Africa.
Africa.
How cold and snowy is your Christmas? Well, Tracy, unfortunately, we can't afford snow. Nah, I'm just playing. We're in the Southern Hemisphere, which means when it's freezing in Connecticut, it's fantastic in Cape Town. So forget your winter jacket. Pack sunscreen.
Hi guys, I'm Kai Gabiam from the Diaspora Channel, a lover of Africa. If you love Africa as well, and you would love to visit one day or to relocate to Africa, there is a course out there for you. And this course is my first trip to Africa, a course well put together by a seasoned traveler, Kellen Cash Coleman. This course is designed to prepare you to travel better, which will save you both time and money. And the great news is this course costs only $20, guys. It can't get any better. Go right now and enroll to this course at www.diversifygame.com. Don't miss out.